It's 5 o'clock somewhere, Real Estate Investor Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking to Nick Huber.
That's correct.
Huber with an H.
Absolutely.
Right? He's with Pinnacle Financial Partners, and we're going to talk about some different types of products and mortgages and some other things that are going on in the real estate world, so stay with us.
We are sponsored by Title Assurance and Escrow, a title company here in Cordova that does all of our closings, title work, escrows, and we only use Title Assurance and Escrow. That relationship is very important because we can get things done for our investors quickly and easily. So to speak with Title Assurance and Escrow, call 901-737-3332. Ask for Chris or April.
Hey, Nick, welcome. How you doing?
Thank you. Glad to be here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us today. And real quick, I'm going to tell everybody who you are. You said you're born in Irving, Texas. You played college basketball and received a bachelor's and a master's degree at Mississippi College?
Yep.
Really?
Actually, baseball, not basketball.
I want my glasses on. It does say baseball. My bad. So where did you play? What position?
Well, I started off playing catcher and first and in junior college back in Dallas, and then played third base for the last 2 years at MC. So
cool. Very cool. Went pro, though, huh?
No, I actually came to Memphis. What brought me here was the Olympic tryouts in 1988.
Really?
And I came up here and tried out and obviously didn't make it. Pretty talented groups back then. But, yeah.
And you decided to stay in Memphis?
Stayed in Memphis. Well, you know, honestly, it was a girl, you know, baseball.
So,
there the truth comes out.
We've all done dumb stuff for women. Trust me. We've all been there and done that. I know. I once moved to Michigan because of a girl. So
yeah.
I'm not going to fault you for staying in Memphis. At least you're closer to home than I was.
What's wrong with Memphis?
I mean, you come from Texas.
Born and raised here, man.
Well, I know. Well, prime example. That's true.
Absolutely.
You know what? The truth be known is a lot of people always, because I'm from Louisiana, Baton Rouge. Moved to Michigan for 10 years, moved back to Baton Rouge, and then relocated here after Katrina. I always get asked if I would move back to Louisiana. And I love visiting way more than I did when I lived there. Right? The food tastes better. There's just so much more going on.
Right.
When you go visit versus when you just live there every day. It's like living next to Disneyland. You know, people ask me, oh, it must have been cool being able to go to New Orleans, you know, 30-minute drive. Well, yeah, once you've done it 100 times, you really don't do it anymore, right? So I enjoy visiting. Number two, I can't make the money that I make in this market anywhere else in the country. The investment market here is just phenomenal. So it's kind of twofold. So I'm not going to say I'm stuck here. But yeah, I'm stuck here because I can't retire, so I gotta work for a living. But I'm glad you ended up in Memphis. So let's talk about, you're with Pinnacle Financial Partners. Tell us who Pinnacle is. I know Pinnacle Bank. Is that a division of Pinnacle
Same
Bank?
Thing. It's a small regional bank based out of Nashville. It's kind of got a triangle from Miami to Memphis up to D.C. A little over $50 billion company. So okay. They're rapidly growing.
Small company.
Yeah. Yeah. They're,
business, that is small. Actually.
I started with Pinnacle after 28 years with Wells in 2019, and they were about a $25 billion bank.
What did y'all do at Wells Fargo? What did you do at Wells Fargo?
I worked for two or three different subsidiaries with Wells, some consumer finance, some home equity lines of credit.
Right.
Worked at the bank and then transitioned over to the mortgage department in 2002. Once I got off the road and stopped traveling. So
much easier job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pinnacle's a great company. You know, the culture's different. A lot of companies will say they've got a great culture, but until you experience it and you kind of taste it and see it and you embrace it, then you realize that there's something special there. So
most upper management says they have a great culture,
Sure. But
it's only because they need you to believe that. But I mean, I've heard good things about Pinnacle. Mm-hmm. I think Title Assurance and Escrow banks at Pinnacle, and they talk highly of their banker there. They really love being there. I'm actually with Regions, and I'm having a lot of technical issues on their app and technical issues with Zelle. And every time I call customer service, I can't even get anybody to even help me. So I'm actually fixing dump the ball on them and then move on. I've actually been thinking about Pinnacle, believe it or not.
Yeah, I mean, the mission statement was, you know, to provide effective advice and distinctive service.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the big corporations these days, you know, they've gotten a little impersonal.
Very impersonal.
When you call Pinnacle, when the phone rings three times, somebody's going to answer it.
Right.
And you're going to talk to a human, and that's important. So, you know, a lot of the customer service issues go away when you've got human beings that pick up the phone. So we're proud of that. Yeah, very proud of it.
It drives me nuts when I have to call Regions because you go through the number selections up to 9, and then you select 3 for Zelle, and the AI says, well, I know you want to talk to a customer service rep, but here's another 9 options you need to listen to and pick from. And then by the time I get to somebody, that's always the same thing. Well, it must be an internal problem. There's nothing I can do to help you. It's like, why the hell do you have a customer service department? It irritates me. I think banking and a lot of the large corporations have just lost touch of the fact that you're in business strictly because of the people depositing money in your bank.
Absolutely.
And when you start treating them like second-class citizens, they're going to start leaving, and you're going to struggle.
In this day of technology, too, you know, it's the day of instant gratification. You know, and
I'm a little guilty of that. I mean, I was a little perturbed when I couldn't fix the Zelle in about 15 minutes. You know, back in the old days, you had to go to the bank and sit down and talk to somebody.
Right.
Now it is more instant, and maybe I got a little irritated with them, but they just can't ever fix anything. They have problems, but they can't fix them. So
switch to Pinnacle.
There you go.
I'm actually thinking about it, believe it or not. After talking to April, she was talking so highly of her banker, so I may go see her next week
Give us a little history of Pinnacle in Memphis. What's some of the local banks? Y'all scooped up a lot of banks here locally, haven't you?
Yep. So, like I said, I've been with them for about 6 years, but Pinnacle purchased Magna Bank.
Okay.
So Magna Bank was kind of an offshoot with Krylike, Dick and Harold, and, you know, the innovation of Magna Bank and Realty Title. With the Dodd-Frank Act, I think, if my memory serves me correct,
They had to get rid of them.
They kind of had to part ways, and so it was the perfect timing where Pinnacle, based out of Nashville, went ahead and purchased a bank and, you know, that already had brick and mortar facilities, kind of a takeout with the merger and acquisition. It was a real natural fit. Magna Bank had a beautiful mortgage presence here in this city that they built, and they had a sterling relationship, and they still do today. But that's kind of how Pinnacle got started in the Memphis market, was through the purchase of Magna.
All right, well, let's get into do what our listeners want to hear about. Let's talk about mortgages.
Sure.
Now, you do residential mortgages. You said you also do investment, don't do commercial. If I'm an investor and I'm looking to purchase a couple more rental properties, maybe a couple single families, a couple duplexes, what products are available at Pinnacle for these investors?
Yeah, great question. So, like you said, I primarily deal with 1-4 unit single families, condos, things of that nature. Product mix is pretty basic, I would say, fixed rates. You have ARMs, but it's just the investors right now do not have an appetite for ARMs. So,
well, they're just so uncertain what's going to go on with the rates. Right?
Exactly. And, you know, they're afraid they have actuarial tables to where they're going to keep these loans for 3 to 5 years. And if they perform, but people are going to refinance out of them quicker is kind of the mindset, in my opinion, as far as why they're not trading any better.
It's not really a good market for on either side, the banking side or the investor side.
Right, right.
Not a good product.
So fixed rates, just depending upon how much you put down, normally 20% is normal and customary. You get a little better rate with 25% down. You get a little better rate with 30% down. That's kind of the benchmark there. At Pinnacle, too, we also have kind of what we call tier pricing. Mm-hmm. So with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which is who most of our underwriting guidelines go through, if you borrow below $250,000, you get a little better rate. If you borrow below $225,000, you get a little better rate. So forth and so on. So kind of
so
makes it a
the lower the loan amount, the better rate you get.
Yeah. Yeah. It's seems a little odd.
It does. It seems to me the more money I borrow from you that I qualify to borrow, the better deal you're going to give me.
But I think in this case, they think that people are less likely to refinance a $85,000 loan.
True.
You know, if you had to refinance that, how low does the rate have to go to provide a tangible benefit for you to do it?
Especially if they're refinancing something they've had for 6 or 7 years and
paid most
and their rate's like 3.2% currently.
Yeah, yeah.
So
sounds like a good excuse to downsize.
Pretty much. You ought to do that.
And that helps, you know, even I know, you know, if you're buying a new primary residence, some of the reluctancy is, you know, I got a 3% rate.
Right.
If you're going to pull $300,000 in equity and you're only going to borrow $100,000, it's a little bit more palatable to pay a little higher rate because you're not going to pay as much.
I think it's a little more. I think it has a lot to do with emotion. And, you know, if you really run the numbers, let's say you bought a house for $300,000 at 3.5%, and tomorrow you could sell it for $450,000, and you can go get your dream $650,000 house, and your rate's going to be 3% higher. But if you wait until rates come down, that $650,000 house is not going to be $750,000 or $800,000. So, you know, I think you got to sit down with the math and realize that just because interest rates aren't exactly where you want them or matching what you currently have in your current home, doesn't mean it's not a better buy. Would it be better if the rates dropped tomorrow and you could buy that house? Sure. But I mean, how likely is that to happen? I don't see rates coming down until maybe the end of this year, probably for sure in the first quarter of 2026. That's my thought.
Well, you know, as soon as housing prices go back up like you've been saying they're going to do every month for 6 months, these guys sitting on the fence waiting on a quarter of a point rate drop are going to wish they bought it.
I know.
Six months ago.
It's a common thread. Mm-hmm. Rates go down, prices go up. I mean, demand goes up, prices go up.
Tell me if I'm wrong, I'm just ballparking, but if I'm looking at $150,000 rental property and rates are at 7.5% and I'm waiting on that to drop 0.5% before I buy that hunter. How much money am I saving a month? $18, $28?
Not much. You're exactly right.
I buy the house 8 months later, it's now $175,000. I've just bumped my monthly payment up a couple $100. So,
and a lot of times people,
rates aren't an issue for me.
Right. And they shouldn't be. You know, people make money when in real estate when rates are low, and people make money in real estate when rates are high. They make money, you know, with the values of homes because they've consistently gone up.
Well, what I find is a lot of younger investors don't take pencil to paper and do the math on it to see if buying today a little bit higher interest rate but a better pricing and how that compares to waiting till January 2026 when the rates drop and then buying that same home, but yet it costs you $15,000 more. And if you do the math on it, I would think it'd make more sense that if you can get a 6.8% rate to there, even 7, would make more sense than paying $15,000 more for it in 6 months.
Exactly.
Because that $15,000, if you bought it today in January, now you're going to have a $15,000 equity growth in your property, as well as, I mean, a minimal increase in cost because of interest rates, but it's not significant enough. I think they get so caught up on the cash flow, how much money am I making every month clear, that they lose sight of the value of the property itself. Right, it's like they're just buying a vending machine. They don't really care about the value of the property.
Yeah, you can't lose sight of the big picture long term, which is why we're in this to begin with.
Right,
we're not in it necessarily for the cash flow.
It's a generational wealth. You know, that's in my opinion the number one value that comes to mind. I can tell you in 2019, you know, we had some clients that got into homes, first time home buyers, little to no money out of their pocket, might have bought a $170,000 house. Do you know what that house is worth today?
Oh.
270.
Yeah, exactly.
People bought it 250. That house is worth now 360. That's generational wealth. That's 5 years of appreciation where they can take that $100,000 and go buy the next house. They can, you know, buy multiple homes. They can buy one, but...
Or pull the equity out, invest it.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's all kinds of things.
Absolutely, but you can't do anything if you're sitting on the sidelines waiting for rates to drop a quarter of a percent, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's too many investors, and we have a lot of activity with investors. I mean, don't get me wrong. We have a lot of activity. Probably not as stellar as it normally is, but a good bit.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in lowball mode right now.
Yeah, but right now it's a buyer's market. They're all coming in, you know, lowballing and low offers because they think everybody's desperate.
Mm-hmm.
We get all kind of weird offers. But at the end of the day, no one is sitting down looking at the whole picture. Right. Somehow they've got it in their mind that if I'm going to buy investment property, I'm buying cash flow only, cash flow only, cash flow only. They're not looking at the equity growth. They're not looking at the asset wealth that comes with the growth of that equity. You know, if you end up with 10 homes that appreciate $200,000 over the next 20 years, I mean, that's $2 million, right, in asset wealth. So somehow they've gotten lost in this cash flow. And I blame it on these California seminars. You know, they all have these billion-dollar ideas that they want to sell to you for $1,500 a pop, and they sell them. And these kids get the wrong idea on how to invest in real estate. And a lot of them go into it and go bankrupt in a couple of years and never get back into it. So I'm kind of hoping we get a correction here. I don't want to see rates drop to 2% or 3%. I'd like to see them drop 4.5%, 5%, a reasonable number. And then we get a little bit of an equity growth, but not that, you know, that 2021 boom where things just exploded through the roof and went up 300%. You know, I'd like to see a balance on that. And if we see a balance in the market, I think maybe at that point we'll get some more balanced, reasonable investors buying back into the market instead of just buying cash flow. Foreclosures are at a peak here in Memphis right now.
Nick, give us your take on what the market's going to do from this day forward. Be optimistic.
It's going to fluctuate. That's what Buffett,
as optimistic as it gets.
That's what Buffett said. I was.
It's good answer.
I'm going to date myself, but he said,
"What a classic line."
At a seminar, they said, "You know, what are rates going to do?" And he said, "They're going to fluctuate. You know, it's what's your tolerance for risk. You know, what's your investment philosophy? This isn't a one size fits all." I would say that I'm optimistic that rates are going to dip. Mm-hmm. I think this current administration is heavily invested in real estate. You know,
right?
The commercial real estate has taken a bath here recently. That needs to get fixed. Housing is it's the backbone of America, and affordability is gone to some degree for some people right now.
Housing is the linchpin of the American dream. I mean,
absolutely,
right? That's the whole American dream.
Absolutely,
that was sold
the nucleus of the economy.
Yes, it
in
is.
My opinion.
I mean, if you own a home, you're buying groceries. You're shopping at Lowe's. You're buying a lot. You're putting furniture in it.
Gas bills.
Absolutely.
Putting new roofs on it.
Exactly.
Hot water tanks in it.
Yeah.
I think it's the nucleus of the economy.
So we don't need rates to get to 2 or 3 again.
Well, because if that happens, it's great. You can get a 2% rate, but a lot of people get priced out of the market, right? Because now they're back buying the same house they live in now, but it costs more.
I see activity picking up when rates drop, you know, a half a point.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the last time rates were 7% was 1998. In 1998, that's when the market dipped, and rates really never got above 7 again until about 2-3 years ago in 22, when it went from 4 to 7.
Right.
That was insane. And it really slowed the market because people were extremely nervous.
Sure.
I don't think we'll ever see 2-4% rates.
I hope
again.
Not. It'll be great for guys like us that sell property because we'll be selling, you know, houses left and right. We'll be flinging them out the door. But overall, for the entire housing market and the investment market, really low interest rates are devastating, because what it ends up doing is it just shrinks the buying market so much that it then it rubber bands back, and all of a sudden 3 years from now, we're struggling to sell property because there's not enough buyers. So I think I understand the Fed is not anxious to lower rates. He wants to keep them where they're at. I'd like to see him drop them over the next 12 months, maybe, you know, a point and a half, and then kind of hold it and just kind of see what happens. But, you know, I don't want to see a 2% interest rate or a 3% interest rate. I think it'd be devastating for us.
And here's something for everybody to understand is prime rate, when the Feds meet, that's not a rate that's set for your long-term fixed rate mortgages.
Right.
That's a short-term rate that goes off home equity lines of credit, credit card rates, bank overnight lending rates. The better index to watch and follow is your 10-year treasury.
Okay. What's that at now?
4.5.
4.5.
It was 4.5 this afternoon. That needs to get to about 4. If it gets below 4, that's when you're really going to see some movement with your 30-year interest rates, and you're going
to
see...
Well, explain how that works. So the Fed drops it to... The 10-year drops to 4. Explain to our listeners how that affects a 30-year. How does it affect how Pinnacle decides interest rate to give you?
Explain it to where I can understand it.
Yeah. So banks and mortgage companies are in business to make money.
Sure.
And typically, if they borrow money at 4%, say the treasury note, they're looking at about 2.75% margin by the time they got to pay all the fixed overheads, pay for this,
so that's
pay
their
for the...
Their rate to you is 6.7 or whatever.
That's exactly correct. 6.75. What's happening right now is lenders are taking less of a margin, because volumes are down and they're needing business. And so if the 10-year's at 4.5 today, now they're taking 2.5% margin instead of 2.75, and that's what kind of gets you that rate of 7%.
Right.
Each lender can kind of vary and play with that a little bit. But
it's really up to the lender rate they're offering you.
But it doesn't go up above, so 4% 10-year, add your
margin,
cost of doing margin in, that brings it up to 6, I'll just say 6.5%, and the lenders are charging me 7. But that's all competitive. You know, I'm not going to get greedy and charge everybody 8 because I got to be competitive.
That's exactly correct.
But there's no cap on that, right? They can charge whatever they want.
They can, but I can tell you right now, going back to the advent of the Dodd-Frank Act, not that I'm a big fan of government legislation, but that was good. Helped wash out some people that needed to get out. But what it did is pricing became very competitive. And it's hard if you drive down the street and you see gas at $3 at one gas station and gas at $2.75 at another. Which one are you going to?
Sure.
But if you see gas
I'll drive 20 miles to save 4 cents a gallon.
Yeah. So right now pricing, you know, is closer between competitions. So gas at $2.75, it could be $2.76. You're probably not going to switch over that.
Sure.
And so banks, you know, that's where they're pretty closely aligned with those.
It's almost
rates.
Like going to Lowe's and Home Depot. You walk in, same price on every product, but one's orange, one's blue.
Pretty much.
That's really the only difference.
Yep. Not a lot of difference.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. So why do they make their rates based on the 10 years? Is it because they know they're going to sell that loan off, or there's going to be a refi out of it? Or what do they do when that loan, the Fed loan matures in that 10 year?
I'm going to go back real quick a second. The fees are some other things that can differentiate lender to lender.
Gotcha.
So, you know, if we charge $1,200 and we disclose that, then we may be able to charge you no points. If somebody else is charging you 2 points, they may be able to give you a little lower rate, but what other fees are they charging in there that can make that up?
Well, I think everybody's experienced hidden fees in mortgages. We've all been hit with that before.
And that's what's good about where we're at in today's environment, because you can't drive to the closing table without having seen final numbers 3 days in advance.
True.
And so your question around the maturity of the bonds, it just kind of goes into a big pot. It's a real hard question to really answer.
Yeah, I was always curious when that loan matures, how does that reaction between the bank and the Fed, what happens then? I mean, does the Fed adjust the rate now based on what the going rate is that day, or do y'all sell the loan off to another servicer?
Exactly. So at Pinnacle and probably 99% of the other mortgage lenders in the country, they're going to sell loans off to larger investors, PennyMac, Mr. Cooper, which just got bought by Rocket Mortgage.
Right.
You know, they're growing their servicing portfolio. I mentioned to you, I was at Wells for many, many years. Wells had about a 25% market share in the servicing portfolio. Just think about that.
They were huge in that. Before 2008, they were huge.
25%. So that means one out of every four homes in this country that were financed were being serviced by Wells Fargo.
Right.
So Wells Fargo had these huge pools of money. And so they could sell them off depending upon, you know, the yields and the bond markets. And it was a very lucrative business.
Yeah.
And it's costly to set up adequate servicing processes and platforms and put those in place. Yeah. The packaging up of multiple loans and multiple selling, you know, it could be sold 3 or 4 times.
Since you're a mortgage consultant, let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
I come to you. I've got a 780 credit score. Got a good job making a couple hundred grand a year. Got 30, 40 grand squirreled away in the bank. And I decided I want to buy my first rental property. Never bought a rental property in my life, but I own my own home. Got some cash, got good credit, got a good job. What product would you suggest for me as a new investor? What would you consider to be a good product for me to look at and consider?
A lot of it's going to depend on what your short-term and long-term financial objective is with that property.
Some people, I'm going to hold it for the next 10 years and keep adding to it.
Yep. Some people want to buy and flip. And some people want to buy and hold.
Right.
So until I understand that, it's hard for me to make an accurate recommendation. But sure. I'm conservative by nature. I'll give you options. There's not as many as what there used to be. You know, the interest-only features have kind of gone away.
Right.
You get some non-QM loans, which are non-qualified mortgages. Those are kind of outside the scope a little bit.
Right.
But I just don't think there's anything better right now than your traditional fixed rate.
Better than the hard money loans and DCSR loans and all that stuff.
I mean, you know, those are, everybody's in a
Depends
different
on the situation.
That's exactly correct.
Well,
you know,
the only negative with DSCR loans that I've recently found out about is that a lot of them have prepayment penalties, 3 to 5 years. So if you're an investor, you pull out a DSCR loan on a property, and let's say 3 years from now, you decide to move that portfolio and get rid of it and invest in a condominium building down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of, your prepayment penalty is huge at that point.
Right.
So it doesn't make sense to sell. So you've got to hold it 3 to 5 years. The ones I've seen average is 3, but I've seen a lot of them at 5. So there's the 30-year fix doesn't have a prepayment penalty, does it?
No. Okay. And with our Freddie Fannie loans, you can have up to 10 financed properties.
Right.
So that's where it depends on what your philosophies are. The DSCR, if you're wanting to build a portfolio of 20, 30, 50, 100 properties, then I'm limited from what I can do from where I sit. Then you have to get into the other type lending platforms that open up and expand for you to have multiple properties.
Okay.
With that, obviously may come the prepayments, the risk is elevated to some degree, and that's probably why those hard money lenders are, they're there for a reason.
They are. So what's a quick rundown on Pinnacle? So you got the fixed.
Mm-hmm.
What other products do you have for investment lending?
We have, you may have owned your home. So we've got from a banking perspective, you can set up home equity lines of credit to where you might be able to purchase a property quickly.
Just pull the equity
for cash. You know, you get into a situation like that. So it's always nice to have a couple different avenues to where you can access liquidity.
But could I pull $100,000 equity out of my home and put down payment on 5 rental properties?
You could, yes.
If you qualify.
Yeah. And that's where, from my standpoint, we look at W-2s, we look at tax returns, we have to use a qualifying income perspective.
Sure.
But as long as, you've got the income and the assets, like I said, this is where I'm capped at 10 properties. You can buy 10 financed. We don't co-mingle collateral, so if you had 4 free and clear that were worth $50,000 each, we couldn't make you a $150,000 loan on those 4 pieces of property for $200,000. That would fall underneath like commercial loans, but that's where our bank, may have an appetite for that type of lending.
Sure.
And maybe some other banks may as well, but we can get as creative as we need to at times.
Well, in my opinion, that's the key. Every investor comes at us and wants a lender referral. We have a couple people that we work with.
Sure.
And I've had some go to this particular lender and just come back and say they don't have anything I really want, and they find a different lender. So I know that every lender's got its own requirements, got their own programs, their own type of whatever interest rate and fees and whatever. But mostly I find that most of them are kind of the same. The only thing you mentioned is that y'all do not do DSCR. Does Pinnacle have anything in the works for providing DSCR loans to investors?
No, not at this time. I think it's just something that takes a lot of specialization.
Sure.
There's certain products and programs that when you just don't do them consistently and over again, they can be more detrimental than they can be advantageous.
I agree.
The
only reason why I ask that is because a lot of investors are going to the DSCR because, let's face it, a lot of the investors are self-employed.
Right.
And when you're self-employed, the qualification process for a loan is a nightmare. It is mounds of paperwork and tax returns and all this stuff.
And
the DSCR loan is simply based on the income of the property and your credit score, correct?
But if you're self-employed, there's nothing that an income tax return wouldn't clear right up.
Oh, come on, Jeff. You know damn well that we don't claim all of our income. I mean, come on. If we did that, I'd be broke. IRS would own half.
I was trying to sell my contracting business. First thing the lady said was, I need to see your...
You need to start paying your taxes more.
I need to see your bank statements versus your
tax returns.
I'm like, I misplaced both of those a couple of days ago.
Yeah, that's a downside. And that's why a lot of these guys go to DSCR.
Yep.
I mean, you've heard that story over and over again. You get somebody's tax returns, they're trying to get a mortgage, and they've written off stuff that, is probably grayish area to write off. It's allowed. But you have to tell them, look, if you're not showing enough income. Even though they have the money, they make enough money, but they're writing off so much other stuff, or maybe they have a side business, or they own some other real estate, they're deducting or depreciating as much as they can off their personal income taxes. Almost as if they have a boat, exactly. Exactly. That is a good tax deduction. I brought your British ass on my boat. Jeff and I hang out there every other weekend. Marissa's going to come down sometime this summer. So that is a legitimate business write-off.
But don't draw too many red flags to yourself with it.
The IRS doesn't listen to our show, and if they do, I'm just kidding.
I got buddies that bought boats and their company names and write the whole thing off. I'm like, no, I don't think that's how it works, man.
Nah.
You're just asking for trouble, drawing too much attention to yourself at that point.
If you've ever gone through a loan process to buy a rental property, it's an arduous process. I mean, they want everything from your shoe size, your blood type, sign your firstborn over just in case you default. It's hard. So DSCR is kind of brings me back to the days when they used to loan money. Is they check your pulse. Oh, you got a pulse? How much you make? $1 million here? Great. Here's your mortgage. I mean, it was so easy. DSCR to me seems like it's going down that path where they're just loaning money as fast as they can. So I hope we don't have a repeat of what we had in 2008, where we had a bunch of mortgages out there just all defaulted.
Yeah, well, that's my concern. I think you should just stick with old Nick over here and go for your 15-year conventional. Be done
well,
with
and,
it.
And
well, you get a better rate, right?
You get a better rate, but here's the thing. When you go DSCR, look at who your investor is. A lot of that's going to be hedge fund money. It's going to be private equity monies. Mm-hmm. They may be more collateralized lenders, okay, where when we sell everything to Freddie and Fannie and it's got to be in this conforming box and you can't have a toe outside, we can't jeopardize a borrower's ability to repay.
Sure.
And that's the critical component to that. So the DSCR monies, they're quicker, they're a little bit more expensive, and they're just kind of saying, hey.
I think they're riskier for the lenders or for the investors that are putting mm-hmm. that the money's coming from. I think they are, because let's face it, you're qualifying a guy on credit. You're not really checking his income. You're just basing it off the property income. Well, what if the property goes vacant? Does the guy have the reserve funds too? Now, I do know that some require a certain amount of reserves in the bank, but mm-hmm. I don't know what that percentage is.
So all this regulation stuff that came down the pike after 2008 that was supposed to protect us from predatory lending, and you guys are doing the right thing, protecting your client's ability to be able to repay the loan, which is the way it should always be done, but if the regulation's pretty much the same, how come the DSCR people are more lenient on?
So they can play by different rules.
Are they just pushing the envelope
They can somewhat play by different rules. You know, like even in the banking industry, you got credit unions.
Right.
You know, they borrow money differently than banks do. And
because credit unions are considered nonprofits.
Exactly. So there's just a little different.
I was always under the assumption that the regulations were just across the board, no matter what type of.
It really depends on where the money comes from, how you're loaning it, what your structure is. Like hedge fund groups operate in almost a totally different set of rules than a conventional lender mm-hmm. like Pinnacle Bank or Bank of America or Wells Fargo.
You're right. That DCR stuff, I mean, it's getting out of hand.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. But I mean, I hope it keeps going because it's good for our business. Well, Nick, tell everybody again who you are, who you're with, how they can reach out to you if they got any questions about mortgages, or maybe that we got some guys that may be interested in going down that route and discussing the 30-year fix with you.
Yeah. Nick Huber with Pinnacle Financial Partners. My phone number is 901-568-5601.
Email?
It's nick.huber@pnfp.com.
Personal home address and cell phone number?
You want my social security number?
That too, yeah. We'll take that.
Yeah, routing number and account number?
Sure.
I'll be glad
absolutely. Anything you want
to
give us. All right, Nick. Thank you for being here. Thanks, guys, for listening. If you have any questions, remember, you can call us at 901-692-7401 or go to our website, MyMemphisInvestmentProperties.com. Please go on our app and subscribe to our podcast so we will get notified every time your beady little ears are listening. We'd love to hear from you through our website. If you have any topic ideas you want us to discuss or experts you want us to bring on, we'd love to do that. So reach out to us. Have a good day.
For more common sense real estate tips, listen and subscribe at 5oclocksomewherepodcast.com. The 5 O'Clock Somewhere Real Estate Investor Podcast is a Sound Ideas Group production.